You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
Welcome to KCBS In-Depth, broadcasting throughout the Bay Area and streaming on the Odyssey app. I'm Mary Hughes. Last week on In-Depth, we heard parts of KCBS's I'm Listening special, where we turn our focus onto mental health, suicide prevention, and the ways in which people can find hope and healing. So now we're going to hear the second part of the KCBS I'm Listening hour, starting with my conversation with Eleanor Sosa Pace, Chief Officer of Residential and Justice Programs at Momentum for Health in Santa Clara County. So, Eleanor, the new Adult Residential Treatment Center had its ribbon cutting just last month, and it offers a transitional space for those who may be dealing with a myriad of mental health issues. How important is this new center for the county and for those who need it most?
I think, to be quite honest with you, it's been a long time coming. We've really needed this additional program. We currently have the only adult residential treatment program that's on our White Road campus on the east side. It's a 45-bed program. Actually, a lot of times, you know, when we have clients that are ready to transition to that program, there's quite a wait list for it. So having these additional 28 beds, it couldn't have come at a better time, because we have so many clients that are also waiting in locked psychiatric hospitals that have been there, for the last maybe, 6 months, 9 months, year, that are ready to step down. So having these additional beds, these resources for them, has just been really important. So we're very excited that we were asked to, also manage and run this program for the county. And we've done a terrific job also just staffing them so that we can meet their needs. It's been very challenging over the years, especially with so many of them that are dually diagnosed, that we have also with very serious medical conditions that require our nurses and our doctors to stay on top of them in order to keep them stable while they're with us.
There are so many elements to getting a place like this up and running, and it can be challenging, I'm sure, to make sure that everyone's needs are being met, but it could be so rewarding as well.
What is probably the most rewarding piece is seeing them come, from a program that's been locked. So, that in and of itself, to be in the community, to allow them a safe space, a place where they're going to be finding a lot of support around them. They're going to be creating many, lifelong linkages to case management, to their psychiatrists, to their medical providers, and also just seeing them thrive in that environment, whether it's for 9 months that they're there, sometimes they're there, a year. This program in particular will be up to 2 years that they can reside there. But again, this is a time for them to really build that support and rapport with their providers, so that they will know once they do leave our program that they'll have the necessary tools, they'll have the necessary linkages, so that they will be able to thrive in the community.
One of the major aspects of this conversation we're having with I'm Listening is how mental health is an everyday part of our lives. From your perspective, with all the work that you do and you're involved in, how do you view this shift in importance that we're giving to mental well-being?
ultimately, it's about creating hope, right? And making sure that there's, you know, a safety net and a really, you know, strong, continuum of care to meet everyone's needs depending where they are. So we have, launched, our 988 number to call for, any kind of, mental health support for anyone. So always knowing that, there are people that are there that are willing to help. And for individuals that have family, loved ones, students, whatever it is, that there is support for them. We are very lucky that Santa Clara County does offer such a strong and rich continuum of support. This 988 launch has, certainly been something that, we've needed for quite a while. I'm very excited to be a part of that as well. So creating hope, creating awareness, I think those are, key things that we need to always remember that, everyone matters. Every person, in this world matters. And in our county, we don't, we're not giving up. We're going to continue to make sure that there's resources available. Our residential programs are there for those individuals that really need that additional support so that they can be able to gain more, help with developing tools to be able to succeed in the community.
Eleanor, thank you so much for being a part of this conversation and speaking with me.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Next up in this mental health conversation is Chuck Ingolia, President and CEO of the National Council for Mental Wellbeing. It's a nonprofit association and the voice for many organizations that deliver mental health and substance abuse recovery services in America. Chuck, thank you so much for being a part of the I'm Listening conversation.
Mary, it's a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
So since its launch, 988 has been reached out to almost 5 million times nationwide, and that seems to reflect that this new number, which replaced the longer National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number, it seems to show that this is working for those who need it most. Is that what you would say?
I think so. As you know, Mary, just think about how you even just described it. It's hard to remember that 10-digit number, isn't it? And the whole kind of rationale that led advocates and Congress to agree on a 3-digit number is we wanted to make it easier for people who might be having a problem to be able to recall a 3-digit number and to reach out for help.
Well, and I think that's, one of the things is simplifying our ability to do outreach, simplifying what we can find for ourselves if we are in times of crisis or times of need. Was that something that was determined to be needed and sort of precipitated this change?
Absolutely. The federal government had been supporting the suicide lifeline for many years. And I think it's also, a kind of a recognition that we don't want to wait until people are at the point of contemplating taking their own lives to be able to offer them assistance. And so the switch to 988 being the suicide and crisis lifeline was also to make sure that this resource was available to anyone having any kind of mental health or substance use challenge, that they would have a place to reach out to offer them support and assistance.
Well, and I know that with anything like this, anything that's new like this, the lifeline itself will continue to evolve and to grow. We're seeing some of that recently with 988 adding American Sign Language services for the hearing impaired. How do you see this service furthering its reach over time? What does that look like to you?
Yeah, I think you raise a couple of really important points there, Mary. One is we're at the very beginning of hopefully what's going to be a long journey of the continuing evolution of 988 as a resource to people in this country. And if you take as a corollary the evolution of 911, it took many years for that infrastructure to be built and for people to recognize and feel comfortable calling 911. And so we're at a very similar kind of evolution with 988. We have indicated that this new three-digit number is universally available in this country. But even in your introduction, right, you talked about it is one number. And, you know, so we still have individual organizations, individual localities offering kind of alternative numbers. I think one of the interesting things to think about over time is how do some of these things come together? Do we see less kind of coalescing perhaps around 988 as being the single number for people to call? And also, you know, if you think, you know, the standards that the federal government, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration talks about in terms of kind of the three aspects of crisis response, a place to call is but one part of that. And obviously it's the principal one. Most people who call the lifeline have their issues resolved. They're able to get the support or assistance that they need, and they don't need anything further. But some people need additional support. And so there are two additional components related to 988. One is mobile crisis response, and then the second is crisis receiving facilities. And those second parts will continue to evolve and come online over time.
I know that there's a lot of, you know, sort of nuts and bolts that go into making something like this work and work for as many people as possible who need it. And from your perspective, you know, what sort of hurdles does this hotline still face? And, you know, are there ways that we, and I mean, you know, individuals to states and so on, can do more to support it and spread awareness of the number and what it offers?
So, wow, great question. And a couple different components of that. One, I think the most important thing is, you know, SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA.gov, they have lots of resources available. So bookmarks and stickers and magnets related to 988, and anybody can reach out to SAMHSA and request these materials. And, you know, part of the thing we can do is you know, give these out as stocking stuffers or gifts at parties or include them in birthday cards, you know, to make sure that more people are aware that 988 is available and as a resource. So that perhaps is one thing. And I think one of the kind of most important things over this last year that has really made 988 a success is that there's been a tremendous amount of funding from Congress to SAMHSA to support the evolution of the lifeline. And we need to make sure that that funding remains constant, as well as in many states, lots of investment of state funds also to support the 988 lifeline infrastructure. And so I think, you know, one of the things listeners can do is to really help advocate for resources for 988 in an ongoing way, both with the Congress in Washington, D.C., and with state legislatures.
You know, so much of what specials like I'm Listening and others reveals to us is that there are people out there to listen, to help, to advocate for those who need care. 988 does play a huge role there, and so does the association that you are president of, the National Council for Mental Wellbeing. For those who aren't familiar, tell us more about the council and what it does.
Yeah, the National Council for Mental Wellbeing was founded almost 60 years ago to be the voice for, at that time, a brand new industry of community-based mental health and addiction treatment services. There was the evolution of people leaving state psychiatric hospitals and this desire to create a system of care for people as they came back to their communities. We know, unfortunately, that investments by state and federal government did not keep pace with need. But there are so many organizations that we represent, about 3,400 around the country, that are not-for-profit or government-affiliated, that make it their mission to provide needed supports, services, interventions to people with mental illness or substance use. Our job is to represent their interests, to make sure that there is, you know, the best we can to ask for increased funding and support so that people can get care in their communities when and where they need it.
Well, and that's it's good hearing what the National Council for Mental Wellbeing is doing out there, for especially on this macro, you know, level. And one of the elements, though, that I found most interesting to the work that you and this organization does is providing information and courses in something called mental health first aid. What is this exactly?
Yeah, mental health first aid is an international program that was developed initially in Australia and is now in 29 countries, including here in the United States. And it's a course to help people develop their mental health and substance use literacy, to understand what mental illnesses and substance use disorders are, how they manifest themselves, and most importantly, how to have a conversation with somebody who might be experiencing a mental health or substance use challenge, how to do so empathetically, in a supportive way, to offer hope, and to understand that how to connect people to services if they need them. And so the whole kind of purpose of mental health first aid is to make us all feel comfortable being a support to our family members, our colleagues, our friends who might be experiencing a mental health or a substance use challenge. Just put in context, we are much more likely to experience somebody having depression or anxiety or other challenges than we are somebody having a heart attack. And so, you know, we want mental health first aid to be as common as CPR in this country.
What are some of the aspects to this that in particular that you could highlight that people are learning to use and have, you know, as first aid for situations like this?
Yeah. So, you know, again, it's a lot of this is just trying to understand that, first of all, what people might be experiencing. And so that you, there's a mnemonic that goes along with the program called ALGI. And the first part of it is like assessing the risk for suicide or harm, listening non-judgmentally, giving assurance and information, encouraging appropriate professional help, and then encouraging self-help and other kinds of self-care. So those are the five components that the course really teaches someone to feel comfortable being able to offer to somebody else who might be having a challenge.
Has it been something where, I mean, you said it's in, you know, many countries, and is it becoming more a part of our toolkits when we are working with mental health and mental health issues?
I hope so. I know we've seen a lot of growth here in the United States in mental health first aid. I'll just share a couple of things. One, you know, the success for 988 really is dependent upon people feeling comfortable reaching out and asking for help. And it seems to me that something like mental health first aid is a huge component of that, that it kind of normalizes mental health and substance use and hopefully remove some of the fear or shame or stigma that somebody might be experiencing to reach out for help. And I think it's also very practical. I just was in Topeka, Kansas earlier this week and listening to, I was at a summit for mental health first aid instructors. And the woman speaking shared a story that she was teaching a mental health first aid class last month. And during the class, one of the participants got a text from a friend and was able to immediately use the lessons that she had learned in that class to offer support to her friend. And so I think the other really, you know, it's really practical and gives people skills that they can use right away.
That's fantastic to hear. This work that you do, and that those everyone who's involved with the council, and of course in the broad range of mental health services that do exist here in this country and around the world, I have to think that with working this long with behavioral health and mental health, you've likely seen so much change in how we approach these topics. You know, what strides have been made since the time that you have been in this position?
Well, I would say, you know, that COVID was really a game changer in my mind, reflecting on, you know, how long I've been in this industry and what I've seen. You know, I think COVID has, you know, the if I think about SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, they have been saying for years, as our federal leader, that mental illness and substance use disorders are real, that they're common, and that they're treatable. I don't think most people understood that before COVID. And, you know, I think so many folks have reported distress associated with the social isolation and disruption that we've seen in COVID. And, you know, I think there's a growing recognition that indeed these illnesses are real, common, and treatable. There's been a corresponding kind of recognition at the federal and state level by policymakers to make additional investments in providing care. And so I'm just blown away by how much progress we've made even over the last 5 years, let alone the last 30.
Well, and I think that what you just said there, you know, might segue very nicely to my next question, which is, you know, what is your outlook now when it comes to this work that's being done around mental health? And, you know, where do your hopes lie for what's to come?
Oh, wow. So I'd say two things. One, I think, you know, we're at an incredible point in terms of recognition and support. And we're also at a point in this country where there continue to be lots of challenges. Most specifically, as a country, we have just a lot of workforce challenges globally. I think I'm not aware of any industry right now that is not looking for additional staff. And healthcare generally is no exception. And mental health and substance use also shares that same dynamic. And so my biggest... I'm so glad that there's a desire and recognition for people to want to get care. And my biggest concern right now is that our workforce challenges really prevent us from being able to deliver that. So that's my fear. My hope is related to work that's underway in a number of states to really rethink how mental health services are organized and financed. There's a federal demonstration program called Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics that's now up and running in 10 states. An additional 15 states are contemplating bringing this model, and we know that over the next 8 years, more states will be joining this federal initiative. And I'm so excited because these Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics have to provide services in their community to anyone who needs them, regardless of their ability to pay, regardless of their diagnosis, regardless of their insurance coverage. And that has me so excited that all of us would have a place to go in our community whenever we needed it, where we could get evidence-based, responsive care.
And that seems to be something that I've heard in other conversations that I've been having, that there's work to be done, and you have to sort of recognize that there's work to be done, but it is being done. And there are so many people who are behind the push to make mental health care more accessible to more people and to put themselves out there when it comes to talking about suicide and suicide prevention. And having the tools is a huge part of that. I appreciate you sharing so much about the mental health first aid. And sort of a last question for you is, you know, what would you say to someone out there who is struggling or who needs help? You know, what would you say to them?
I would say, you know, don't suffer in silence. Reach out for support. You know, the 988 Lifeline is available 24/7, and there are compassionate, trained individuals ready to offer support to you. There's no reason for anyone to suffer in silence, that there is help available, and please take advantage of it.
Yes, thank you so much. Really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me about this very important topic. Chuck Ingolia, President and CEO of the National Council for Mental Wellbeing. Chuck, thank you so much.
What a pleasure. Thank you for doing the segment.
As you heard there in my conversation with Chuck Ingolia, 988 is the number to call if you or someone you know is experiencing a mental health crisis, or if you just need someone to talk to. You can call 988 to get in touch with a trained counselor near you. And all of the I'm Listening program that you heard on In Depth this weekend and the one before, that's all available on the Odyssey app. And additional resources can be found at imlistening.org. You can find this episode and past episodes of In Depth online at kcbsradio.com. Just check the podcast tab and look for KCBS In Depth. You can also hear the episodes on the Odyssey app. Download the app on your smartphone and favorite KCBS radio. Thanks for listening. For KCBS and In Depth, I'm Mary Hughes.
You've been listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.